What were the true motives behind the assassination of President John F. Kennedy? How are U.S. intelligence agencies implicated in the grooming of supposed lone gunman Lee Harvey Oswald and in the Kennedy shooting? Were there any significant revelations coming out of Kennedy files released from the National Archives? Why do so many government critics seem hesitant to embrace the notion that U.S. government would and has carried out conspiracies like the Kennedy assassination and 9/11? On this week's Global Research News Hour, in the lead-up to the 54th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, we consider what is known about that event and its relevance today. We'll speak with the author of a seminal work on the subject of the assassination, James W. Douglas. We'll hear from ex-CIA analyst Ray McGovern about the recent release of documents on the assassination. And we'll hear from scholar and professor of economics Paul Zaremka about left denial surrounding state crimes against democracy in general. On this week's program, the plot against Kennedy, why it matters in the era of Trump. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 17th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The situation with North Korea is terrifying. I see the stealthy buildup of pressure on the Security Council, similar to that preceding the Iraq and Libya invasions. The Russian-China veto prevented an attack by the UN on Syria, but Russia and China are not vetoing these vicious sanctions on North Korea and permitting this incredibly provocative US ROK military surrounding the DPRK. What deals are being made? On October 13th, the DPRK sent another emergency letter to the United Nations Secretary General Guterres. This was the third letter sent to the UN since November 20th, three letters in 23 days, attempting to alert the United Nations to the crisis situation in Northeast Asia, jeopardizing international peace and security, a crisis that could precipitate nuclear war at any moment. All three letters have been ignored, raising alarming questions about the UN's commitment to save humanity from the scourge of war. That comes from the article, "The Situation in North Korea is Terrifying. U.S. ROK Military Threats are Provocations for Nuclear War," by Carla Stea, posted November 15th. The East Ghouta's terrorists are exploiting a sense of empathy of the international community. They don't want to get UN and Assad's humanitarian aid. Instead, they prevent any aid to be delivered into the Damascus district. To arouse the storm of indignation from all over the world with the aim to break the siege, they draw the pictures of starving and exhausted children. So the Western real goal is to force the Syrian Arab army to stop the siege so that the terrorists could regroup. That comes from the article, "Syria, Media Disinformation Campaign Blaming Assad for Alleged Famine in Terrorist-Held East Ghouta, Fake Accounts, Photos," by Sophie Mangal, posted November 14th, originally appearing at Inside Syria Media Center. Israel has instructed its overseas embassies to lobby their respective host countries in support of Saudi Arabia and its apparent efforts to destabilize Lebanon, a recently leaked diplomatic cable shows. The cable appears to be the first formal confirmation of rumors that Israel and Saudi Arabia are colluding to stoke tensions in the region. Sent by the Israeli Foreign Ministry and disclosed by Israel's Channel 10 News this week, the cable demanded that diplomats stress Iran and Hezbollah's engagement in regional subversion. That closely echoes accusations Riyadh leveled against Tehran and the Lebanese faction in recent days. Analysts have noted that diplomatic moves by Israel to intervene directly in a seemingly internal Arab matter are, quote-unquote, very rare. That comes from the article, Saudi-Israeli Collusion? Is Israel Seeking Role as Leader of the Sunni Bloc? By Jonathan Cook, posted November 14th, originally appearing at jonathancook.net. Annual reports from the MOD's internal watchdog, the Defense Nuclear Safety Regulator, or DNSR, have been abruptly classified as secret. Published for the last 10 years, the reports have repeatedly warned of the dangers of spending cutbacks, staff shortages, and accidents. But now, the MOD says that the reports will be kept under wraps in the interests of, quote-unquote, national security. This has prompted a tirade of accusations that it is trying to hide embarrassing concerns about nuclear safety and avoid public scrutiny. DNSR annual reports since 2006 have been released by the MOD after an early challenge under Freedom of Information Law. That comes from the article, Trident Nuclear Safety Report Suppressed by British Ministry of Defense, by Rob Edwards, posted November 14th, originally appearing at heraldscotland.com. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Published in 2008, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, is acclaimed by many prominent analysts as one of the seminal texts on the subject of the Kennedy assassination. The author is James Douglas. James W. Douglas is a longtime peace activist and writer. Together with his wife, Shelley, he's co-founder of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Poulsbo, Washington, and Mary's House, a Catholic worker house of hospitality in Birmingham, Alabama. His works include The Nonviolent Cross, The Nonviolent Coming of God, Resistance and Contemplation, and most recently, Gandhi and the Unspeakable. He joins us now from his home in Birmingham, Alabama. Welcome to the program, James Douglas.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Now, in the premise of your book, you identify the influential American Catholic mystic, writer, and Trappist monk Thomas Merton as providing guidance in your investigation of the JFK assassination. What unique and important perspective does Thomas Merton bring to an overall understanding of this subject?
Well, first of all, I had the gift of knowing Thomas Merton. I used to visit him at the Abbey of Gethsemane, where in the hills of Kentucky, he had, I believe, a deeper understanding of what was going on during President Kennedy's time in office than practically anyone inside what they call the Beltway of Washington. He had eyes that were formed by contemplative prayer, to be quite explicit, in a very profound way that enabled him to see what I couldn't see in those days when I was visiting him, nearly anything remotely like he could, and that even today, I think we have to learn from him. He saw things in terms, especially of the unspeakable. He wrote a great book called Raids on the Unspeakable, and from his contemplative perspective, he was able to see things like the Holocaust, the nuclear arms race, the racism that was and is destroying this country and many other countries. He saw them as a depth of systemic evil that defied speech. And in his book, Raids on the Speakable, he called it a void. He said the unspeakable is the void that contradicts everything that is spoken, even before the words are said. The void that gets into the language of public and official declarations, at the very moment when they are pronounced. Think of the Warren report, which was being written just at about the time that he said those words, wrote those words, and makes those words ring dead with the hollowness of the abyss. The unspeakable is the void out of which Eichmann drew the punctilious exactitude of his obedience. So from the standpoint of this book, it's the void out of which people executed John F. Kennedy for becoming a peacemaker as President of the United States.
And in terms of becoming a peacemaker, I mean, you argue JFK went through a transformation during the last 3 years of his life. He was essentially going from a functionary within this violent and brutal state apparatus to a man of peace. And,
yes.
And the need to and so there was a need to contain Mr. Kennedy's turn away from that military-industrial complex. I mean, that was essentially, you know, the motive behind the assassination. So
it was indeed.
So what were those critical turning points? I mean, there were a number that you list.
Well, one of the first was the Bay of Pigs invasion, which Kennedy was manipulated into and lied to by the CIA. He was told that the brigade, the Cuban exile brigade that had been trained during the Eisenhower administration by the CIA and was being deployed in to overthrow Castro, he was told that they would be supported by the bulk of the Cuban people. Total lie. And he was told also by his intelligence agencies, with the CIA leading the pack, that the landing would take place in an area where the brigade could become guerrillas if they were not successful immediately in their beach landing. Well, there wasn't any area where they could become guerrillas. I mean, it wasn't the whole terrain was totally different from what he had been led to believe, and he was just manipulated by the CIA. And the whole point, as Alan Dulles confessed in a very quiet way in a manuscript that never appeared anywhere, the whole point was to put Kennedy into a position where, in order to win over against the Castro government, he would have to call in the entire force of the U.S. military and engage in a total invasion of Cuba, which he had said even before he reluctantly agreed to the Bay of Pigs he would never do, and he held his line. And he said very specifically after the Bay of Pigs, "I want to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds," which was cited in the New York Times after he was assassinated, and not put into any context as to the reason for his assassination. Then, of course, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which Kennedy was largely responsible in many ways for almost incinerating the world, along with Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro, all of them for, quote, good reasons. They all had, in the conflict over the missiles being put into Cuba by Khrushchev in support of Castro to stop Kennedy, well, really from stopping the CIA in its further efforts to overthrow Cuba, all of them, quote, had good reasons, but it was terrible for the entire world and terrible for the countries of each of their governments. And Kennedy, in the midst of all this, turned, and I use the word in the biblical sense, metanoia, shuva, repentance, turning. He turned toward his enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, at the most bottoming out part of the missile crisis, when Kennedy was losing control of his own government because the military were so pushing so hard to invade Cuba, and were actually trying to antagonize the Soviet Union in such a way that they could justify an invasion of Cuba. At that point, Kennedy sent Robert, his brother, the Attorney General, to Anatoly Dobrynin, the ambassador in Washington, and appealed to Khrushchev to pull the missiles out of Cuba, and Kennedy would agree to pull his out of Turkey and would pledge publicly never, ever to invade Cuba, nor would his government ever invade Cuba. And at that point, Kennedy was beyond the pale in terms of embracing Khrushchev in a way that Kennedy was closer to Khrushchev than he was to his own national security state. And Khrushchev, in turn, in responding to that appeal and saying to his foreign minister, we have to help Kennedy. We now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war. At that point, those two men turned to each other in such a way that one would be assassinated by his own government, Kennedy in the USA, and the other, Khrushchev, overthrown by his own government, the USSR. And that's that key one. But to choose just one other one, in his American University address, June 10, 1963, John F. Kennedy called publicly for an end to the Cold War in a speech that Khrushchev called the greatest speech any U.S. president has made since Roosevelt. And from that point on, they were working closely together. They signed a nuclear test ban treaty together. Kennedy began a back-channel dialogue with Fidel Castro to normalize U.S.-Cuban relations. And he issued National Security Action Memorandum 263 to withdraw U.S. troops from Vietnam. And at the very moment that he was being assassinated in Dallas, his unofficial representative, Jean Daniel, a reporter from Paris, was meeting with Fidel Castro in a beginning dialogue between Kennedy and Castro at the very moment he was assassinated in Dallas.
So we end up with that motive to take him out, and we see like one shadowy figure in the person of Lee Harvey Oswald, who was being identified as the single lone guy, lone gunman, lone nut, whatever you want to call him. But of course, there's a pattern of involvement which you outline and others have outlined that indicate that he's had long-standing connections with U.S. intelligence agencies, CIA, FBI, going way, way back. Step by step, moving forward to through New Orleans So I'm wondering if you could just maybe address that point, maybe some of the most salient points with regard to that specific figure.
Lee Harvey Oswald was working with the CIA from the time he was a U.S. Marine. He was a radar operator with top secret clearance at Atsugi Air Force Base, the CIA base in Japan, at the time that the U-2s, which he was responsible for tracking, he was a key guy as a Marine at Atsugi Air Force Base. He tracked the U-2s when they crossed the Soviet Union or China. And when he was discharged from the service under a very questionable, bogus reason, he was within weeks over in Moscow stating that he wanted to declare his allegiance to the Soviet Union, and then he stayed there for a couple of years. And he was being monitored and encouraged all that time by the CIA, and especially by James Jesus Angleton, the head of the CIA counterintelligence. This is all in the documents and sources that I used in the book. So it's the key counterintelligence person in the Central Intelligence Agency who's the guideline for and the guide for Lee Harvey Oswald's movements in the Soviet Union when he's a so-called, actually a fake defector to the Soviet Union. So his whole background is preparing him once he's back in the United States and once Kennedy begins to make these turns for a role in the assassination. And through the summer and fall of 1963, he's prepared for that in both New Orleans and in Mexico in ways that he himself doesn't understand. He's part of the plot, but he thinks he's part of the plot in a completely different way than being the scapegoat. And there's a prior plot in Chicago, which is totally analogous in planning to prepare to kill President Kennedy to what actually happens in Dallas, where another man named Thomas Arthur Valley, who was like Oswald, a CIA-connected ex-Marine, currently employed in a building overlooking a parade route for President Kennedy on November 2, 1963, 3 weeks before his assassination. Everything is exactly the same, but there's a whistleblower. And the whistleblower, perhaps not coincidentally, is named Lee. I think the whistleblower was, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald, and that he prevented Kennedy being killed in Chicago and then himself became the scapegoat in Dallas. He was, in fact, if that's true, that's just based on some strong suggestions in what happens in Chicago. If that's true, then Oswald was a hero in Chicago and a scapegoat in Dallas.
And, of course, in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald got shot, and as they say, dead men can tell no tales. Interesting coincidence.
He got shot 2 days after he said to reporters publicly, and it's on tape and it's in videos, "I'm just a patsy." He shouted that out as he was being led through the courthouse. And you can hear it yourself if you Google the right stuff on YouTube or somewhere.
Yeah. There was, in Dallas itself, there is a figure by the name of Ed Hoffman who brings an interesting dimension.
Wonderful man, Ed Hoffman.
Yeah, somebody who's a deaf-mute.
Yes.
And so he was able to observe some suspicious activities in the area of the grassy knoll.
That's right.
And is in particular two suspicious figures, the yes. suit man and the railroad man. Basically, so you want to maybe just outline some of those the points that came out forward from Mr. Hoffman that should really deserve attention.
Ed Hoffman, of course, because in 1963, a person who was a deaf mute did not have the ways that one has half a century later to communicate with people. Deaf mutes were basically shunned or confined to an area where they couldn't get out their testimony. So he was standing on a bridge and looking with a perspective behind the grassy knoll. So he, in the time before the motorcade came, that he had gone to this bridge to observe from a dental appointment. He went to look down in the area behind the grassy knoll, but especially to see the president come by and come under his bridge. He watched this one man prepared with a rifle to shoot the president, and he raised the rifle, and as soon as the limousine had passed by and the president was hit by the man's shot. He couldn't hear the shot. He could just see the rifle being raised and something happening to the president. And then the man turned quickly and threw his rifle to another man who put it in a bag. The second man was dressed like a railroad operator. The first man had on a suit. And then they quickly moved in directions where they could be taken out of the area. He just observed all of this behind, from a perspective behind the grassy knoll. And then he tried to get it out for days, months, years, and both because of his difficulty in communicating, and secondly, because his relatives, one of whom was in the police department in a key way, they all discouraged him. Don't, because they knew that if he got it out effectively, it would be very bad news for him personally. It's a great, great story, and it's one of the many witness stories that I told in the book about people who raised questions that, like President Kennedy, risked their lives, and some of their lives were actually taken, not Ed Elfin's.
Mm-hmm. And that does kind of speak to another point, and I think we just about have to round it up, but moving forward to 2017, that there is a lesson for us in an age of the war on terror, 9/11, and we're seeing these same forces in play, that the story of the assassination and ensuing cover-up of JFK, it's something that almost like a parable, it speaks to the actions of individual citizens today, not the least of whom you might think a particular president by the name of Trump. So I'm wondering if you'd like to maybe help bridge the realities of the how the realities, the cover-up, the collective denial, how that can speak to people today, and how we can act, how we could perhaps model our behavior on on the transformation that JFK underwent.
Well, it's almost impossible to understand the pressures that Kennedy was under. I've had to work on it for a long time to begin to get into that kind of understanding. And the intelligence agencies today and the military-industrial complex and the entire apparatus of the United States government and its allies is based on the same power that Kennedy resisted from the center of it, but as Martin Luther King and Malcolm X resisted from the outside, whose assassinations I'm working on also, and Robert Kennedy resisted like his brother from the inside. All four of them went down to that, and if anybody today stands up in as powerful and effective a way as those four people did, we can expect the same. And we ought to feel good about it, because people all over the world are struggling against those forces. And whether that it's Trump or somebody else in power, it's exactly the same forces that took down Kennedy. If you can take down a Kennedy, you're going to immobilize any other president and terrorize him, including Trump, who's surrendered entirely to his generals at this point. So Trump is not unique. We're the ones who are unique, and we have the power through nonviolent resistance to turn as even a president of the United States could and did, and we can transform this situation. If he could do it from the most unlikely place in the world, the Oval Office of the White House, we can do it.
James Douglas, I'm really honored to have had you on the program, and I want to thank you for sharing these insights with our listeners.
Thank you so much, Michael, and peace be with everybody out there, and let's all take our own steps toward the kind of nonviolent transformation that can change our world.
We've been joined by James Douglas. He is the author of the 2008 book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. And he joined us from Birmingham, Alabama. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. A number of documents relating to the Kennedy assassination were scheduled to be released this year from the U.S. National Archives in accordance with the JFK Assassination Records Collection Act. In spite of President Trump's assurances he wouldn't hold back the scheduled releases, the FBI and CIA have been successful in delaying the releases of hundreds of documents on the grounds of national security. To help us discern what is and is not in those documents and the overall significance and relevance to the broader story, we're joined once again by Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst with a 27-year record with the agency. He's co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour, Ray.
Thank you, Michael.
I should point out that on October 30th, at Consortium News published an article of yours with the provocative title, The Deep State's JFK Triumph Over Trump. And since you that article was published, there have been two major releases. I'm wondering if anything has come out in these the first 2 weeks of November that's caused you to change your thoughts about this release of documents, if there's anything significant there that people should be paying attention to.
There's a simple answer to that, Michael, and that's no.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all, no. They're very selective. You know, the mind boggles at the fact that so long after the assassination and so long after Congress decreed that these documents should be released, the CIA and the FBI still insist that several not be released, not even in redacted form, and even more important, the President of the United States bows to that kind of pressure. So for those who think that the deep state is some kind of construct by conspiracy theorists, it's real. And for Trump to be in the embarrassing position in the morning to have promised full release of all these documents as required by law, and then in the afternoon, oops, sorry, we're going to give the FBI and CIA, we'll give another 6 months to finish the job of picking out what's to be released. And we're still going to hide the names and other data. So hang on, folks. 6 months, we'll get it all right.
There have been some comments about, for example, some revelations in some of the commentary around, for example, Oswald's dealings in Mexico. And there was some this idea that someone who was not Oswald was masquerading as him, and there's been some I guess you might say revelations, but I'm not sure that there's been very much that wasn't already known in that regard.
Well, a lot of the documents had already been released. Others are still redacted. But the bottom line, Michael, is that this is a very complicated, very detailed, and I'll use the word, conspiracy. Now, if people want to sort through it, and it takes attention, okay? There's a great book out. It's been out for 7 or 8 years now. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable. It's by a fellow named James Douglas. I know him well. He has integrity to just don't quit. Now, he spent about a decade going through everything that had been published before, including the documents already released by congressional edict. And his answer is, yes, there is copious evidence, if you put it all together, that the CIA and the FBI were involved in this thing, even parts of the Secret Service and other, well, the military, of course, who hated Kennedy and feared that he was soft on communism. It's just that, the thing reads like a detective story. I mean, it's an easy read, but you have to pay attention to it. And, this is indicative, Michael. Mm-hmm. No one reviewed the book. Okay? No one. So, what do you make out of that?
Yeah. And we did have a chance to talk to him as well, so that there's that broader picture's already been painted. But I know that in terms of the way these intelligence forces operate, I mean, there's always that official story. The official story, trumpeted by mainstream sources, is that Oswald was the lone gunman. But then there's, you know, what my understanding is that in releases of this kind, there's always a kind of like a backup story in case people stop believing the lone gunman theory. They'll have a backup story. And do you see these releases as somehow playing into that strategy?
No, they're just being fed to the public as though they added something to the story, but they're carefully crafted and carefully redacted and carefully excluded to disguise the whole story. Now, what's different here and what's really interesting and important is that Trump is taken on or has taken on the deep state big time, okay? Now, the big state, which includes the very cooperative mainstream media, have painted this story that Trump really owes his election to Vladimir Putin. Get that, okay? Well, the steady drumbeat has gone on almost forever, for a year, okay? Now, what has Trump done? He's taken him on. He said, I don't believe that. I don't believe my own intelligence people. As he said that, okay, so what does that mean? Well, that means that he's acted in a way that John Kennedy did, and in other words, refusing to bow to the power of the intelligence agencies, and he's been warned specifically about this. Now, was this some oddball on the media? No, this was a senator who was the Democratic leader in the Senate, who has spent 18 years in the House, 18 plus years in the Senate. His name is Chuck Schumer. And on 3 January of this year, he warned Larry Trumaudow, the big star on our talk television. He says, look, Donald Trump is taking on, this is words, quote, taking on the intelligence community. More from Schumer, quote, let me tell you, Rachel, you take on the intelligence community. They have 6 ways from Sunday getting back at you. So for a practical, supposedly hard-nosed businessman, Trump is being really dumb to do this. Well, he's done it. Now, it's going to be really interesting to see if he can spirit out of the CIA evidence, I mean, like real evidence, that the Russians interfered with our election. Because in my view and the view of much more technically apt people who work with us and veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, it's all what we call in the Bronx a crock. It's all invented. There is no tangible evidence that the Russians did this, and particularly the celebrated hack of the Democratic National Committee can be proven from forensic evidence. Okay, forensic evidence like the principle of fluid dynamics, which is physics. Physics doesn't lie. That hack was not a hack. It was a copy onto a external storage device. On the 5th of July, represented as a hack by the insertion of Cyrillic, by the insertion of a MS Word type format known to be Russian. The whole thing was contrived. And if Trump takes this on, as he gives some evidence of doing, this is really interesting. Trump instructed the head of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, to have our principal scientific analyst from our veteran intelligence professionals for sanity visit Pompeo and brief him for a whole hour on the 24th of October. Whoa. Now, why would he do that if he believed his own people? And why would Pompeo and Mr. President, that's a really nice gesture, but the evidence is solid. We don't need to talk to Bill Binney, for God's sake. He has a whole different story, and he supports it with forensic evidence. But we don't need to talk. And here's the evidence. If you make me talk to Bill Binney, my troops are going to be really, really upset. Now, why didn't Pompeo act that way? Because he doesn't have any evidence either. And he was happy to talk to Bill Binney. They talked for an hour. And what comes of that is going to be really interesting. But that's already, 3 weeks ago. And the things that Pompeo suggested that Bill Binney do, namely talk to the heads of the FBI and the NSA, well, Bill has not been contacted by either of those. And his last encounter with the FBI was with gun-drawn people poking revolvers into his shower when they raided his home for no good reason, because he wasn't charged with anything. And that happened in 2007. So Bill has not had a happy experience with the FBI, but they haven't called him. They're not interested. They're part of the deep state.
And just maybe finally, because it sounds like we're seeing the deep state attempting the same thing they tried to do with JFK, and it just tried to box him in to their agenda, and the president is fighting back. Does Trump have any options at this point other than acquiescence?
Well, theoretically, yes. But he also knows about JFK. Yeah? I mean, his predecessor, Obama, not large, about 12 people, big fundraisers, right? Big money people, at a dinner for Obama many years ago. They were progressives, and they said, why are you not acting like a progressive? Barack, why are you? And he stood up, and he said, look, I'm getting tired of this. Don't you remember what happened to Dr. King? Now, he didn't say John Kennedy, but Dr. King perished the same way, and that's proven in a court of law that the parts of the military, the rednecks down there, there were lots of proof that that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and it was a government conspiracy. Now, when I use the word conspiracy, there's a slander that has been used for everything, including 9/11, and that is you don't want to be branded a, quote, conspiracy theorist, period, end quote. I've looked into that, Michael. Guess where that originated? That originated with Alan Dulles, the CIA director, who got himself appointed to pretty much direct the Warren Commission looking into the assassination of JFK. And when people started saying, well, wait a second now, some people suspect that the CIA may have been involved. What did Alan Dulles say? Ah, these are conspiracy theorists. It's a very convenient way to demean or to dismiss people who are only trying to get at the truth, like Bill Binney and like myself.
And it's worked, unfortunately, it's worked very well, it seems.
We're banned from the media. What I would like to point out is that when they're forcing RT, Russia Today, to register as a foreign agent, well, the distinctive thing about RT, in my experience, is that unlike CBS, ABC, CNN, Al Jazeera, BBC, they don't give me a, quote, pre-interview, end quote, which means that they don't have the producer that say, Ms. Mullen, what do you say about this? What's your take on it? Like, before the interview itself. Now, that is a common practice. And BBC, for example, has interviewed me for 15 minutes and said, well, we really don't need you tonight. We have somebody else. So there you go. Now, RT has never done that. And I'm a regular on RT. And I'm happy to do that because a lot of Americans now are aware that they get the straight scoop, at least from me and others, on RT, and there is they have access to it there, where they don't have access to it in what used to be a pretty big rag, namely the New York Times, which used to print, actually, almost everything that was fit to print. No more is that the case.
Well, you certainly have access to the Global Research News Hour, and I want to thank you very much for joining us, Ray McGovern.
You're most welcome, Michael.
We've been joined by Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst and co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Serious researchers of the Kennedy assassination and other state crimes against democracy have encountered an aversion by members of the general public to entertaining dissident perspectives. This includes those who identify themselves as progressive, left-wing, and even outright critical of government policy. One academic who has probed this phenomenon is Paul Zaremka. Paul Zaremka is a professor of economics at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He edited the 2006 volume, The Hidden History of 9/11, and in 2015 authored a paper, A Challenge to Geopolitical Economy, September 11th and Conspiracy Theory, which argues that the resistance to exploring dissident perspectives on 9/11 is anti-intellectual and that there is a strong basis for alleging state complicity in high crimes historically. Global Research NewsHour managed to get hold of Professor Zaremka while he was visiting Winnipeg for the Geopolitical Economy Research Group's 2017 Revolutions Conference.
I think that part of the resistance of Marxists to conspiracy theory about something like September 11th is that September 11th shows the state in a very bad light. I think there is a certain part of Marxism for which the government itself is important. They want, for example, government-run healthcare, this and that. Okay, if you get too, I think this is a subtext. This is not conscious. I think that they don't want to go too far with criticizing the state because it can bounce back to the idea of a state-run economy. You follow what I mean? Okay. So my guess is that, and it's kind of a hypothesis, people who get more interested in state planning under socialism would probably be more resistant for that reason to hearing very negative. In other words, it's not, their perception is more or less a transformation, rather than an overthrow of the state. Okay, so I guess there must be something to do there with a different perception of what the revolution is about.
That's interesting, because it seems to me that, when people start looking at some of these problems with the official story of 9/11, and they go to the net to try to find other resources, that there seems to be a preponderance of sites that articulate a more libertarian right wing, and they don't have a problem with shooting down the state.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. The resistance of some Marxists that I'm talking about is, they don't want to go there. They don't want to go to that extreme. But from my own point of view, I always thought that the state was a state for the capitalist class. So why don't we deal with it straight up? Like, okay, don't give it any credit that it's not due. I mean, if it's something is happening, investigate. I still don't know exactly who did what. I'm just saying that one should go below the surface. And there's very deep and very negative things going on below the surface of society. And that's my basic position.
Okay. Well, it's been 16 years since the 9/11 attacks. It's been almost 54 years since the Kennedy assassination, we're seeing a lot more a growth and suspicion of, what the things that the state is doing sort of behind the scenes. Can you look at maybe some more recent developments, over the last couple of years, where you see new turns in the direction of this whole meme of questioning what the state is doing, the conspiracy investigations and the willingness of the public to embrace them?
I don't know.
Okay.
My feeling is that not that much is changing. I try I try to remind people moving away from Kennedy right now, but actually for the Martin Luther King case, there's even much more dramatic case, and that is that they had a trial in 1999 that convicted the government of being partially involved in a conspiracy against to kill Martin Luther King. I mean, it was a normal quote trial of a jury trial where the jury convicted co-conspirators. And it's amazing how many people don't even know that, don't even know that it took place. And that's because the mainstream media doesn't even talk about it, okay? They talk about Simpson's case all over the place, okay? But what that trial was more important than Simpson, by far more important than Simpson's trial, but they don't talk about it. And yet, isn't that what our system was about? I mean, our judicial system, isn't that about if you go to trial of something like this and you find a conviction? Well, that's supposed to say something. It's supposed to say something very big, and it's ignored. Okay. So I meet even very well informed people that don't know that trial in 1999 took place. Kennedy's thing is more well known because we had the movie, you know, the JFK movie, and it made a huge difference in terms of knowledge that what happened to Kennedy was not what was what the government says. But nevertheless, you still read in the newspapers today. If you pick up a New York Times today, you pick up my own local newspaper, Buffalo News, you won't see even a hint that it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald that killed Kennedy. You won't even see a hint of it. It'll either say it directly, the killer of Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, as if there's no issue about it. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, you get this over and over and over again, repeated as if it's fact.
Speaking about fact, right now, in the last several months, there's been a narrative about Russia interfering in the U.S. elections of 2016. And it seems like almost a flip side phenomenon, because that idea has largely been discredited by people like William Binney and veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity. And yet there's no actual evidence that I'm aware of that this took place. This is what would be referred to as a conspiracy theory. And yet this is something that's being embraced when there's far more convincing evidence of U.S. Government officials orchestrating the 9/11 attacks. Yeah. So I wonder if you wanted to, maybe comment on what that reality speaks to you.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I haven't seen any evidence. I don't even know why we're talking about Russia interfering with U.S. election. Why don't we talk about whether the Clinton administration interfered with Bernie Sanders' election. And I mean, there's a lot of evidence that there was a lot of fraud committed.
I mean, I think that there has been a lot of distrust in mainstream media that's grown since the time of the 9/11 attacks. That's my general impression. And so I think that was probably a factor in the U.S. presidential elections.
Yes, it was. Yes.
So, what are some of the hazards now in an era where the general public doesn't believe the mainstream media, but they do manage to reach out to, whatever, media sources, independent media sources, generally reinforce their own perspectives?
When I give one of my classes at the university, I present the Martin Luther King trial case, and I ask students. I'm hoping it that students understand it as there is truth, but it's not always readily transparent. You have to dig down. Okay, that's the way I present it. Okay. Not a long discussion. I'm talking about 10 minutes of class. We have other things to do, but I'm just trying to do that for the students, okay? So, and then I ask an exam question, and only some of them realize that I'm not encouraging them to think that there is not truth. A lot of them think kind of in a Trump way, even though they don't even, they may hate Trump, but they think that it just depends upon who you're talking to, that there is no objective truth here. It's kind of like there's your truth, there's my truth, there's Trump's truth, and you know, that kind of thing. And that's terrible. I mean, we can't have that. Okay, we have to defend the fact that there is reality to deal with. But at the same time, it made me a little bit concerned. I'm concerned that deep down people believe, too often they believe what something in themselves wants to believe, and not want to face the reality. And there's a lot of that, okay? I don't know how to overcome it. Maybe it's just part of modern world, I don't know. I don't have a good answer.
Looking ahead to this avalanche of information that's been opened up by the internet, what do you see coming? Are we going to develop the skills to overcome?
No, but if you're talking about the internet now, I was just in Germany, and a law took effect October 1st. And the law says, as I understand it, the law says that social media firms which allow, quote, something like fake news to appear among any of their users opens the social media provider to liability and heavy fines, not minor fines, heavy fines. And that raises not only the issue of the potential, and what's going to be happening is the prosecution of people who are, the possible prosecution of the individuals, but even more importantly, the prosecution of the fear of, let's say, Twitter or whatever. I mean, I don't know who, anybody, to even allow that kind of material to be on their site, because if they don't take it down within, I think it's 2 hours or something, in a very short period of time, they can be subject to the fines.
So it creates a chill effect.
Yeah, that's what I'm really concerned about, a chill effect. So let's just take an example of September 11th. I mean, could it not be the case that that if September 11th becomes something that they want to erase from discussion, the Germans are taking the first step to be able to do that, to be able to erase it. Now, that we're a long way from that completely happening, because there still can be independent sites and so forth and so on. But to even go down that road of state control of what is going to be on the internet is a heavy problem. And we're starting down that road. I think in England they're doing it also, if I'm not mistaken, but I'm not sure exactly what the laws are
there. Sort of like the 21st century equivalent of book burning.
Yes, right. Correct, right.
Well, very ominous, yeah, outlook, but Paul Zaremka, I really appreciate being able to speak with you this way. I've appreciated your work, and I hope, you know, look forward. Maybe we can have conversations in the future, maybe with better news.
Thanks very much, Michael.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.